free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Sterling Allen, you can join us online at freeenergynow.net, where you can see our past lineup of speakers and links to archives of those shows, as well as our upcoming lineup and a link to, or the list of radio call-in numbers if you're listening live. Our guest today, February 4, 2008, is Chris Patton. Chris is both a friend and a colleague and a fantastic researcher and filmographer and all kinds of fun stuff. He's with Dark Horse Entertainment, a division of Dark Horse Comics, and he also does Zero Point Films. He's pulling together a film on these new energy technologies. We'll be talking about that, and Dr. Yoshihiro Nakamatsu, Joe Holden, and World's Ness, and other stuff. This is a miscellaneous interview.
A little eclectic this afternoon, isn't it?
Good to have you on, Chris.
Thanks, Sterling. How are you doing over there?
Doing good.
Well, I've been keeping an eye on your website this year. I've got to hurry up with my film because you're catching up to me.
Oh, yeah, you got to keep some of your cutting-edge stuff.
I know. I've got to start keeping my mouth shut because it seems like a lot of these guys, every time I mention a little piece of the film, it comes up on your website. I'm going to start clamming up because I think I've got about two items left you haven't shown yet.
You want to have some kind of a edge there, huh?
I've got to have something to sell.
Some reason for people to show up at the theater and pay $5 for a ticket.
It's true.
Well, how's that film coming?
We're pretty good. We've been 14 months in production now. We spent a good 8 months in pre-production. We've shot a lot of the interviews out. For the people who haven't been listening in the last year or so, we started a motion picture about 14 months ago that was a solution-based film on all the technologies that you probably didn't know existed that could reverse the decline of the planet. And it's also a history of how we got to where we're at through energy, power, and fuel.
And when you talk about a history, you're also going to be talking about how there's been things that have developed in the past, like 50, even 100 years ago, which have been collecting dust and shouldn't have.
This is true. We take you back to the origin of most of the fuels, including hydrogen and alcohol fuels, and compressed air technology plays a very big role in this motion picture. We take you through a lot of really interesting compressed air technologies that have popped up every 20 years or so. Something really extraordinary pops up in compressed air vehicles or engines or turbines and just doesn't quite make it to market, but it's an extraordinary find, and it works great. And the efficiencies are much higher than most internal combustion engines.
We have had a couple, at least one people on, or interview on this show. Let's see, what was his name? Angelo Di Pietro, I believe, down with in Australia, talking about that.
Oh, he's in the film. Actually, he's on the list. We haven't gotten down to Australia yet, but he's actually on our top 10 list in the film for actually producing one of the most efficient air compressed engines in the world.
Yeah.
Really, really beautiful turbine design. This guy's really done it. For less than 5 PSI, he's moving his vehicles around at 12 to 25 miles per hour.
Yeah, and when you say he's moving vehicles around, he's got stuff powered by this right now. He's commercially developing this.
It's true. Yeah, he actually has these little people movers that he's got for warehouses and storage areas, and he's moved on to larger vehicles now, and I've seen some tests where he's moving Jeeps and smaller trucks. And this is really smart, really simple, really exquisite technology. We're talking maybe 5 moving parts in the system. Really elegant.
Yeah. It's in our top 100 technology. Hey, I should mention, since the last time we did an interview about 6 months ago, we finally roped in officially as a member, an advisor for the New Energy Congress. Welcome aboard.
Well, thank you, sir. I have no idea what I can contribute other than my opinion.
Well, you just keep on doing what you've been doing. we have our occasional chats, and I get some juicy information, and it shows up on my site, and you have one less thing to cover in your movie.
This is true. Thank you, sir. Now I don't have to talk as much at parties. I can refer to your website.
Right. Just have the opening screen say, see freeenergynews.com.
That's right. That's what the back of my card says now. Well, I've been doing this line of research now in funding for over 14 years, so I've been in the trenches for a long time, and I started out with my own interest when I got back from West Africa. Is I had a gold and diamond exploration over in the Ivory Coast, and I had some turmoil over there during the Liberian Civil War, and when I came back, I spent the majority of my capital on locating suppressed environmental technologies and naturopathic remedies for chronic diseases. So
I want to interrupt you here for a second.
Sure.
And put in a little footnote. When you talk about you had a little diamond business over there and had a little turmoil, they made a movie about that.
Yeah, it was a little thing called Blood Diamond that was a mix and match of myself, a guy named Eric, and a couple of other people that they conglomerated into one guy and turned it into a film called Blood Diamond. I sold the project called Sierra Leone in 1999 to Warner Brothers. And it went over to a group called Section 8, which was Steven Soderbergh company. And it was a team-up between Brad Pitt and George Clooney to do a buddy action comedy film. And that was the project I sold them called Sierra Leone, which kind of snowballed after what happened in 2000. The story came out in Variety about the Sierra Leone wars and the Blood Diamond wars. And then suddenly it got very interesting in town about doing a political piece on it. So they turned it into a buddy comedy, into more of the political piece of what happened to me.
Now, didn't you say they were going to also do a movie called Sierra Leone?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're going back to the buddy comedy that I wrote back in 1999, and it looks like we're spinning that through as a motion picture again. And the Sierra Leone, the reason it got picked up at the time is that there were some studios looking to do a remake of the Sierra Madre film that Humphrey Bogart did back in the 40s, and they wanted to do an update of that one. So I had a timely treatment that I submitted into the studio system at the time where they wanted to do a remake of Sierra Madre. Mine was called Sierra Leone. It was a buddy comedy. It was about diamonds and gold, da-da-da-da-da. And it just so happened that it was in Sierra Leone, so it was just timing.
Uh-huh. My wife got me that movie Blood Diamond for Christmas.
There's a Christmas film.
We actually watched it about 6 months ago, really enjoyed it. I think I gave it 5 stars at Netflix. That was just a fantastic movie.
They did a really good job. I got to say, the writers came in on that one and did a really fantastic job.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, the guy who did Titanic was the head actor in that, wasn't it?
Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah. I couldn't remember his name off the top of my head.
It's okay, I'm required to.
I was going to say Chris Patton, but I... Anyway, well, let's talk about, we'll get back to you were saying that you had a little trouble over in Africa. They made a movie about it, and you came back here and started doing some, just going around, hopping and visiting different technologies. Pick up that story.
I did. What happened was, when I got back, there was something that we were doing in West Africa that I thought was really interesting. My engineering partners, who were in their 80s and 90s, were running these diesel generators on one cylinder, and they were doing a lot of water injection. And they'd set these up where they'd preheat the water and preheat the fuel, and we were getting probably the equivalent of over 100 miles per gallon or so, maybe 120, because we had to run our diesel pumps for a very long time because we had very intermittent fuel supplies. And this is something they've been doing for over 50 or 60 years. Now, when I was there, I didn't think anything of it because I didn't know that's what you didn't do. And it wasn't until I got back to the States that I realized these guys were running practically a emissionless diesel system that was a mining pump. And I started fishing around over here in the States for another one because I was asked to go do another mining operation down in Nevada. And I realized this was a jimmy-rig situation that didn't exist here in the States. So when I started talking to automobile engineers, they didn't believe me. And I thought, well, I can't be the only one who's seen this. So the funding that I'd had left when I got back from West Africa was spent in trying to find a few more of these types of items. And then I started looking at high-mileage fuel carburation systems, cars that were getting 120 miles per gallon, fuel vapor systems from the 1920s and 1930s, like the Pogue carburetor that popped up in 1938. And that just, it sparked my interest that these things, I could find them, and I could find references to them, and I could find a few people that built them. But the majority of people either didn't believe they existed, or they believed they existed and got suppressed. So I just kept pulling the string on all these different little interesting suppression stories. And then I fell into the International Tesla Society back in 1996 and got very deeply involved in Tesla and his research. And then, of course, the people at the Tesla Society were showing a lot of these inventions every year at their Tesla Society meeting. And I would track down those individuals that would show up to the meeting and follow up with them to find out if they had anything that was actually valid or if it just sounded good when it was presented. And through this track over the last 14 or 15 years now, you make a lot of interesting discoveries. You find out there's a lot of hype, but for every large hype, you'll find one guy, one little tiny guy underneath there that actually has something extremely fruitful and extremely useful. Whether he can explain it or not, he can at least demonstrate it. So I felt it was my job, because I used to do a lot of international finance and banking, to maybe pull in some investors to help these little guys discover their science or at least define it easier so that the rest of us could duplicate it.
Now, you spent some time with Paul Pantone.
I did. I spent over a year and a half with Paul Pantone. He was an interesting character. He still is. The device that he had, there's a lot of controversy on it, but I'll tell you this. I did sit with this guy for over a year and a half, and it worked. A lot of people tried to reduplicate it, and there's a 50-50 shot of making his system work depending on how you engineer it. He engineered it very well with his brother-in-law, and the device that he had was like an endothermic reactor, which means you've got a cast iron pipe with a steel rod running down the center of it that he shoved into the exhaust manifold of an engine. The heat coming out of that engine is about 400 to 500 degrees on the exhaust. So when you fire it up, it doesn't work very well for the first 5 minutes. But once that iron rod heats up, you've got cold fuel going into that pipe, into the engine, and hot exhaust going on the outside of that cast iron rod. There was a device that did something very similar in 1958 called a vortex tube. And what happens is when you've got cold air going this way and hot air going over the top, and you've got a hot rod with a cold rod in the center, you get a little bit of a vortex inside. And what will happen is you can get cold air going in one side, and it can come out almost 300 degrees out the other side. And you've broken down the bonds where you vaporize the fuel almost into its constituent gases. And it was a very smart reactor. It was a really clever self-inducing reactor. Now, if you made the rod too short, you wouldn't get a reaction. If you made it too long, the stuff that you were putting in there with mixed fuels, like we were doing coffee with diesel, with gasoline, with water that we'd do for a demonstration, and we'd run that through, and you'd get a clear exhaust coming out that was cold. You were getting a very clean reaction. But if you made that rod way too short, it would just come out blacker than the fuel you put in. It just would gum it up really badly. So there was a lot, there had a lot to do with the configuration. He went on a marketing spree of trying to sell it to a lot of survivalists during 1999, right before Y2K. And it was an amazing device in and of itself. I believe that he tended to over-promote some of its capabilities for the sake of salesmanship. And it wasn't necessary because in and of itself it was pretty extraordinary that you could run multi-fuels off of a standard Honda generator. But that was Paul Pantone.
Yeah, that technology now is being taken forward by Dennis Lee.
Is it?
Yeah, that's what this HAFC, high hydrogen assist fuel cell that they're selling.
Really?
Actually, no, that's the pre-ignition catalytic converter, the PICC, is this Pantone device.
Huh.
Dennis, being promoted by Dennis Lee, and they just took out full-page ads in, like, Popular Science.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Last month.
I had no idea.
They've been selling hundreds of these things. They're actually selling the hydrogen assist fuel cell is basically an electrolysis Brown's gas system where they're putting they're taking electricity out the battery to run electrolysis in the Brown's gas, the hydroxy gas that comes off of that. They're running into the air intake to increase the efficiency, and then they have some other things that go with it, some xylene and acetone and some magnets, and you know they have a package of stuff that you put onto your car, and they claim a guarantee of 50% improvement in mileage, and that is actually a precursor that will fit. The last thing to be added to the mix will be this pre-ignition catalytic converter. Is how they have coined this GEAT reactor?
Wow. Well, I hate to say it to the people listening in on the show, but the majority of the stuff that you'd be buying from that man would be available to you free on the Internet and public domain. He's selling a small Brown's gas electrolyzer, which is a monatomic form of hydrogen that you can make with a very small amount of electricity and a little potassium hydroxide and four strips of stainless steel in a bucket. It's a pretty simple process. So he's taking a lot of information, I'm guessing. I can't make a claim to this because I haven't seen his system, but the work that you know that I do, I've been working in hydrogen and Brown's gas research for a very long time and testing it on automobiles and actually having engines built with these types of systems. And I can tell you that we've been giving that technology away with a couple of groups online for over 24 months on the Internet, and some very good versions of it. And the most efficiency that I've been able to see on doing a Brown's gas or hydrogen fuel injection, I've never seen one exceed 30%. We've done a pretty heavy battery of tests in laboratories and universities on this stuff. This is just injecting fuel into the fuel system itself, not using hydrogen as your source of fuel. As far as doing preheating and things like that, we find that it's really not that necessary. If you could preheat your fuel a little bit, but they've changed the formula so much on gasoline in the last 50 years that the preheaters don't crack as well as they used to. They've gotten pretty smart about keeping us from pre-cracking that fuel.
Yeah. This hydrogen assist fuel cell, the electrolysis is one part of it. It also has, like you said, it has a fuel vaporizer. It's part of the kit. Also contains an additive, xylene acetone, and it has six powerful magnets to help vaporize and ionize the fuel, it says.
Huh.
And so this mixture of stuff that they're putting on there, they're saying that combined that's giving 50% improvement. And I am with you on being quite skeptical about that. That I think is probably going to be high. But they're selling these things, and like I said, this is a kind of a pre-sell to the pre-ignition catalytic converter with this GEAT technology, which they're still working out the bugs because, as you mentioned, the rod length is really crucial, and it depends on the grade of gas that you get, whether it's summer or winter fuel, and it's difficult for them to make a unit that they're going to be able to put on a car that's going to work in a customer-friendly way.
You're very right. The biggest problem with the system when I was working with Paul is that it did not work in vehicles very well because the vacuum in your car changes with altitude and with speed, and it responds really well to an engine that's a single RPM. Lawnmower, tractors, any kind of boat, anything that you're usually running a single RPM on, you get an extraordinary amount of gas mileage gain with this system and reduction in emissions if you've got a single RPM. It chokes really badly in vehicles, and we tested it for a very long time. This is from my own testing and my own R&D when I was with him, is that, you know, you could sell it for vehicles, and you may get a gain if you're idling out or maybe at a stoplight, but when he started hitting high altitudes in Colorado Springs, for example, it chokes out the engine too much, and it was just a very difficult thing. It's not a universal fix-it box, that's for sure. It's something that requires way too much tuning, way too much engineering, and I think if you could figure out a way to regulate the, I don't know, if you could control the exhaust intake or control the vacuum better and put a control system around it so it was a more of an even burn every single time, you could probably get it to work. But just shoving it into your exhaust manifold ain't going to cut the mustard.
Yeah. So they've been working on it for years, and they're now, I mean, with this ad, this full-page ad that they took out, featured that name front and center as if it's ready to go.
Wow.
So
extraordinary.
Probably another Dennis Lee fiasco.
I'm not saying nothing. Kids, if you don't know who Dennis Lee is, do your homework and read up on him.
Yeah. But you talked about this information is available for free on the Internet. The listeners have probably seen these ads on the Internet, waterforgas.com.
You bet.
And what they're doing is they're basically compiling this information and present it in book form that you buy for around, I think, $100.
Wow, is that much?
It's just a book that says, here's how it works, here's where you go to get your stuff, and here's how you put it together. It's just compiled into one in one place. You don't have to dig all over the place.
I see. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Good.
from what I can tell, we're actually looking into that a bit right now with the New Energy Congress, see if we can, if that's something we want to promote, water for gas. Because they've got a little affiliate commission thing where you put it on your site and you get 50% of the sale or whatever.
Oh, I see. Okay. Okay,
yeah, there's a guy in Texas who made $17,000 in 1 month selling that thing.
Wow. Good for him. Well, somebody had to.
Yeah.
As long as it's, here's my thing. If it's a good compilation, God bless them, because it saves somebody who's just getting introduced to all this stuff from having to dig for too long to come up with a solution. If he's actually compiled the best, that's great. The biggest difficulty I've had over the 14 or 15 years now is evaluating what's good and what's bad. There's a lot of data out there, and it all sounds good, but when you really get down to making something operable, has nothing to do with the efficiencies, it's the operation. If you can make it work, that's great, but you're going to spend a lot of money getting to that point, and you're going to go through a lot of engines, and you're going to go through a lot of devices to try to find it out. And when you do a compilation, what I'm hoping is that somebody who's doing the compilation has at least built one or two of them, so they themselves can at least feel good about what they're selling to people and not just compiling everything they find on the net, putting it in a book and saying, look, you can run your car on water. And that tends to be what I've been finding on the net for the last 5 years. It's just a compilation of everything from 1950 to present time. And all of it works, look, put it in your car.
This guy actually sounds like he's not only built one, but he's built a lot and helped other people build them. He knows what he's talking about.
That's good. Good.
Yeah. At least it comes across that way.
That's good. Well, he may be involved with one of our hydrogen fuel groups.
I believe he is. The name Aussie Freedom, does that sound familiar?
Not to me, but that doesn't mean anything because I don't pay attention to the names on the group. He may be involved somewhere back there.
I wanted to talk about Nakamatsu.
Ah, Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu, hero and savior of Japan. This is a gentleman that I'm doing two documentaries on, actually. He's in my motion picture that we're doing right now on all these environmental solutions. But we have a break-off biography film that we're doing on him as well, kind of a Discovery Channel National Geographic special. He granted me the rights to his biography a year ago when I was with him over in Tokyo. Let me explain a little bit about this man. He was born in 1928. One of his first inventions when he graduated from Tokyo Engineering School, I think in the early 1940s, 1942, was a kerosene pump. Now, this is during World War II. They had a lot of fuel shortages in Japan, and there were two big problems. Electricity was getting cut down often, and these little paper houses were very cold in the winter, and Dr. Nakamatsu, before he was Dr. Nakamatsu, engineered a pump for his mother because his mother was trying to carry these really big kerosene canisters and dump the kerosene into the ovens and the stoves, and she couldn't lift them. His father was killed. So he created this little hand pump that it was his first patent when he was like 15 or 16 years old.
Wow.
And he ended up going to, during World War II, Tokyo Engineering University. And due to the fuel shortages, he came up with a heater that was a fuelless heater that still is not sold here in the United States, but it's a remarkable little device that uses compressed air, and he crushes the air into a small cylinder. And he supercharges it and superheats it. You can run water over that hot cylinder, and it heats the water in your house, or heats the air in your house. Really smart, really ingenious little stuff. Now, this kerosene pump, this silly little kerosene hand pump that he invented in 1942, is still sold to this day throughout the world and Japan as the number one hand pump for kerosene pumps.
He was 15, 16 when he came up with that.
About 15 or 16. Let's see, 1928, 1942, what, about 18 or so?
Doesn't he have like hundreds of patents to his name at this point?
Well, this guy actually exceeded Edison. He's up to, I think, I don't want to misquote, he's beyond 3,000 patents. He may be up to 3,400 this year.
Whoa.
Maybe 3,600. He's an extraordinary thinker, and he's very smart about patenting everything that he comes up with. And it's not just patents. He has over 2,200 inventions released and sold to the market. One of the most, one of the most famous inventions is in 1948, he applied for the patent for the floppy disk. Okay, now, here's how he came up with the floppy disk. And this is a story that's been going around the Internet for a long time about Dr. Nakamatsu. They don't believe he did it because the people can't do a backtrace far enough, because it's hard to find patent research going back to the 1950s between the United States and Japan. But one day, when he was moving from Tokyo Engineering School to a new house, he scratched his record collection, and he's a big fan of Beethoven, and he was getting really tired of his records getting scratched. And he thought, okay, there's a better way to do this. Can I put a recorded medium onto a magnetic strip? Can I record my records to some kind of magnetic medium so I don't keep scratching these things every time that I move? So he did, and he transferred them all to a magnetic record. He took the magnetic record and got a patent on it. In 1952, he was granted his patent. Now, here's what happened in Japan. They took this item, and the Japanese embassy was using it as a classified media document carrier. So they'd run it between Washington, D.C. and Japan, and they'd put their classified information on it. And they only had one working device in Japan and one working device in Washington, D.C. And that's how it originated and got started and how he got funded for it. Now, what happened was in 1972 or so, IBM started getting into a lot of research in floppy disks, trying to find out another medium for carrying information. In 1979, IBM licensed this technology from Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu. So it is Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu's invention. He did invent it. There's a patent proof on this thing going back to 1948. He got it in 1952. It was at the Japanese embassy, and IBM has the license to this day. And I believe they've gotten over 15 other patent applications from him since that they've all licensed as well. Now, they're very closed-lipped about this because when you're dealing with internal politics of companies, they don't like to tell you where they buy their stuff. They like to originate things. Mm-hmm. And when you ask IBM or any other company that's originating technologies that you're buying off the shelf right now, you're not going to get a long patent search from these guys. They buy patents and they buy licenses. They don't want to tell you where they originate a lot of things, and it's none of your business. It really isn't. This is what they do. They provide a service for you and a product for you. The origin of it is irrelevant as long as they're branding it. And I agree with them. It's really none of anybody's business. If they got it from Nakamatsu or any of one of 500 other people, that's fine as long as it works.
So 17 years before it was showing up from IBM, Nakamatsu was using it for conveying documented media between U.S. and Japan.
That's correct. It was used in the Japanese embassy between the United States and Japan in 1952.
So we've established that he's a genius. Let's talk about how he's applied that genius to energy.
Whoa, okay. This gets really interesting. He's pushing almost 80 years old this year. He's getting up there. Wow. And you can tell that he's devoted the last 25 years of his life or so to a lot of environmental science and a lot of environmental engineering. Now, he has a fuel cell design that he came up with in around 1988 or so that's really extraordinary. It's a little bit different than the fuel cell design that we've been using with NASA and other countries, including Europe and the United States. The fuel cell designs that we have are usually platinum plates bathed in water, exposed to hydrogen, you know, produces electricity. His design is like a Coke can within a Coke can within a Coke can within a Coke can, and it has a similar reaction. But what he's done is he's combined it with a system where, for a very small amount of energy, he can create enough hydrogen on demand with his reverse fuel cell that he can keep a motorcycle or an automobile running. And he's taken his fuel cell and he's combined it with a small electrolyzer where he's put it into a small scooter right now in Japan. I drove this last January throughout Tokyo. He's got two prototypes currently running where he put a small fuel cell in there with his little homemade electrolyzer and a little bucket of water, and he'd charge it up, and it would blast the hydrogen out of the water, feed it into his fuel cell, and that would run a small electric engine. And we'd run 16 to 20 miles on a small tank of water. And that's what he's applying to his fuel and hydrogen technology. On his home, it's a different story. This man built a $35 million prototype home in the middle of Tokyo, downtown Tokyo, that's off the grid. It's about 5 stories high. There's no solar panels on this thing anywhere. On the side of the house, you've got a Tesla radiant wall made of a really interesting ceramic combination of metals. I can't even tell you what the combination mix is because I was poking at this thing with a pen and a stick, and he was quizzing me for 30 minutes trying to figure out if I knew what was in there, and I I could not figure out what the layers were that this house was comprised of. It's a very exotic mix of his own design, but I can tell you it's like a ceramic composite with 4 or 5 exotic metal combinations in it. It cost him almost $14 million to engineer the ceramic plates for the side of his house.
I have a hard time commercializing that one.
Well, you would on the first run, but since he's come up with the formula, he's got Formula X now, you can remake this batter and this combination very cheaply and easily. He had to prototype it for a long time. And what he's essentially done is he's a Tesla fan himself, and he was awarded some really prestigious prizes a few years ago at the International Tesla Society. And what he did is he carried back a lot of Tesla's research and looked at finding out how to build a Tesla radiant wall, which is an ambient energy antenna collecting not only cosmic rays, but electrostatic, television, and cell phone, and converting those all into useful electricity. So it's an endothermic wall, and that would take up heat from the environment and carry it into the house, because it's black, so it heats up the house, and it produces electricity over 30,000 watts of power.
Now, 30,000 watts, 30 kilowatts, that's going to be enough to keep his house all, is that the only power source?
You know, his house is such a workshop and ongoing research center, it's difficult to say, but this is what I saw. There's what he'll tell you, and then there's what you see. I could tell you that the wall was producing the electricity because I went down to the power room, and I could tell there was 30,000 watts coming in. There's something else that he did that was really intriguing. He designed the house itself to be a wind carrier. So what would happen is you open the front door of the house, and he keeps it open all the time. There's one big door in the front, and you have one big open window at the top of the house on the fifth floor. The center of the house is opened up like a vortex. So when you open the front door, the wind is carried through. A turbine spins in the front door that produces 2 to 3 kilowatts of energy. The fan in the ceiling at the top that vents the air out that helps keep the house air conditioned is also spinning. That's 2 to 3 kilowatts of energy. He's got a cogless generator on there, a cogless alternator, so the magnets aren't grabbing. He's repositioned the magnets inside so they're angled a little bit at 14 or 15 degrees. So as you spin the rotor, the magnets aren't grabbing up, sort of like a windmill engine. So as you open the door to the house or as you keep the door open, during the day when it needs the most electricity to stay cool, these run the air conditioners. So a vent through the house using natural wind ventilation just from having a door open in the bottom and a window open at the very top on the fifth floor venting out to the ceiling creates enough of an updraft that it runs two turbines.
And how much did you say those were producing?
That was producing about 2 to 3 kilowatts of energy. They're fairly large fans. The fans were about 4 feet in diameter, and they're big red fans. And I thought it was an aesthetic choice. When I first entered the house, I wandered down this red hallway as soon as you enter in, and right in front of you is this Willy Wonka fan that's spinning in front of you. And I'm thinking, that seems like a very strange and dangerous place to put a house fan.
Why would Welcome you to my house.
Exactly. It's either to keep dogs or children out. I'm not sure. And then it took about 3 days. I stayed with him for over a week in his house. And it took me about 3 days to really register that this guy does everything for a purpose. There was nothing in there that was misplaced. And I was looking at this red ceiling that matched the red fan on the ceiling that matched the red fan on the bottom floor. And I was looking up there, and I noticed that it was open to the sky, and it was moving pretty fast. And then I looked down at the red fan at the door, and I went, well, it could be just a ventilation system. So I started picking my pen at it a little bit, and I noticed there was a generator attached to it. Then I crawled to the fifth floor and looked at that one, and there was a generator as well. And I pulled him aside, and I said, is that producing power? He goes, yes. I said, okay. Dr. Nakamatsu, how much power is it producing? 2 kilowatts. Oh, I was like, of course it is. And everything in this place has a function. So let me also explain that this man has 5 PhDs, not just one, 5. After he got his engineering degree in the 1940s, he got his first contract and his first patent sold, and he realized that the detriment of all of his partners who also worked at these engineering universities is that they kept getting nailed on their patents. They weren't getting very good licensing deals. So he went out and got himself a law degree. Then he went out and got himself a medical degree. Then he went out and got himself an electrical engineering degree. And then he started working in aeronautics in the 1950s. Something that was really interesting that he invented in the 1950s is Japan has a lot of very heavy mountains, and they were trying to wire Japan with power. They were trying to rewire the entire country after World War II, and they couldn't get these heavy power lines into Tokyo up and over the hills. So he invented these fishing reels that would fit on the bottom of helicopters. that they put these heavy electrical cables on, the helicopter would lift up and ride it and fly it up and over the mountains and attach them to the other side. I mean, just really smart, ingenious stuff like that. He's got a whole battery of 2,200 inventions where you're looking at these things, and you can tell it's when somebody sits down, and this is why I did the second biography documentary on this guy called Inspired Genius. He's a part of a documentary biography between him, another Rolls-Royce engineer named Joel Holden, and my partner Shelby Henderson, who invented the VCR back in 1952. And you take a look at the way these guys used to think in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and early 60s. Whenever somebody had a problem, they didn't wait for somebody else to fix it. They sat down with a piece of paper. They took everything that they knew so far and said, this is what I can do to make this work now. They didn't wait for somebody else to come up with it. They weren't waiting for somebody else to inspire them. They just engineered it up. They took with what they knew now. They didn't wait for somebody to come up with a new area of science. They weren't waiting for a new fuel. They actually engineered whatever they wanted on the spot right then. It took them about a year to knock it out. But you could see that there was a smart carry-through of somebody presented a problem. These guys worked it out immediately, came up with some kind of hodgepodge solution. Whether it was perfect or not, at least it worked, and they got it done. And people like Dr. Nakamatsu and these gentlemen like Joel Holden are inspiring to me, and I think they should be inspiring to everyone else as well, because they still do the exact same thing they were doing in the 40s, which was you present a problem, they sit down with a piece of paper immediately, they work out as many solutions as quickly as possible, and they come up with at least a workable device. And they don't worry about the efficiencies. That's a big thing that I see coming up on a lot of energy sites, and I see the guys from MIT arguing about this, and I deal with this a lot because I deal with the guys at the United Nations, MIT, as you know, and I deal with guys at Pepperdine and Caltech, and I'll see a guy argue with another guy about the efficiency of his system. And that's something that Dr. Nakamatsu and I talk about as well. Does it work? Yes. Then don't worry about the efficiency. Work the efficiencies in later. That's a matter of engineering and material sciences. Just get the thing to work first. So on that same line, when I was talking to him about his house, I said, now that you've spent $35 million building this prototype that nobody else in the world can have because you're the only man in the world that engineered this thing up from scratch, how do you intend on getting this thing out there? He goes, well, I made it work. And I said, well, what about these efficiencies in the house? Aren't you worried about if it's cold here, it won't work here? He says, no. My house is a modular home. I can build this house for $250,000 to $300,000 in your country right now because I've already worked out all the problems for you. And when you start working out the math of how much you think it would cost because of the materials and the efficiencies of catching, let's say, for example, you're in Ottawa and it's winter and it's sunlight for 2 hours a day, you're thinking, oh, my Tesla radiant wall is not going to be capturing enough sunlight to keep the house warm, and there may not be any cell phone towers within 100 miles of here, and it may not be producing enough cosmic radiation. How do you make my house run? Well, he would work out a system, like he showed me when he was there, where he'd take his hydrogen on-demand fuel system that he has in his motorcycle and his scooter, he'd put that in the house, and you'd run your gray water system through it, which would take up the slack for your inefficient wall. And then if that didn't work, you'd take his compressed air heater, which is heating up all his floors for his radiant heating and heating up all the water in his house, and he puts that in there to supplement the heat that's not coming in through the wall. And you just build the system up accordingly.
Now, when you talked about making a house for $300,000 in the U.S., you're actually involved with him, aren't you, in doing just that in Hollywood, establishing a kind of a parrot home to his over here that's not $35 million, but...
I am. I'm officially starting the new American-based Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu fan club for free energy home builders. We're trying to bring his designs, as many of them as quickly as possible, here to the United States because he's got so many fantastic systems that have been working since the 1940s that it would just be silly for us to ignore them. So I did challenge him when I was there to build this house, and we are planning on putting together a Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu house here in California. We haven't determined where yet, but we're searching around Malibu someplace. And it's going to be a challenge not only for him, but my team out at World's Nest. And you know about my team in World's Nest, and the listeners may or may not know about it. World's Nest is a think tank technology incubator out in Taos, New Mexico. It's a 10,000-square-foot mansion that's off the grid. It runs on solar, wind, and hydrogen, and it was engineered by a gentleman named Robert Plahr and his good friend Victoria Peters. And what he did is he used to have a theme park over in Pennsylvania, and he comes from a long line of theme park owners. And back in the 1970s, he decided to take his entire theme park off the grid and run it with wind. Before that was a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, nobody was into this kind of a kitschy thing yet. So in the 1970s, Robert Plarr built this giant wind system which ran all the, he had a water park, he had a roller coaster, it ran the whole park. He was in 60 Minutes and he got, you know, 20/20. Everybody was running stories on this guy. And it kind of faded off into the distance because the kitschiness of it wore off in the 80s. Well, what happened was he sold the theme park a few years ago, moved to Taos, New Mexico, and decided, you know, I want to be energy independent. In his viewpoint, after 9/11, the best way to become homeland security would be to secure your home, secure the energy, be self-producing, grow your own food, run your own gray water and wastewater through your system and use it for your banana trees. Be smart about it. And he wanted to create an example house in the United States so that people could come through, like a museum, touch it, smell it, taste it, and see that it could be done here with recycled parts. And he built it out in an area where they do a lot of these earthship homes that use a lot of the earth and composite materials into the, you know, as a part of the planet, so you're not using a lot of excess materials outside of the earth, using a lot of, you know, car tires, cement, recycled materials, recycled woods, and things like that. So the idea was to keep your carbon footprint really low, use the least amount of materials as possible, build a lot of radiant heat walls so that the sun comes in and you can absorb up all the heat. Now, I'm going to transition this back over to Dr. Yoshio Nakamatsu. Dr. Nakamatsu's design is a little bit different. He's got a very Japanese mindset. They think in terms of modular designs that are built someplace else that are dropped on site for last-minute construction. Now, if you take these two design concepts, like what they have at World's Nest with Dr. Nakamatsu, what you end up with is using the least amount of materials as possible, still using a lot of radiant heat, compressed air heater systems, flywheel windmill systems as ventilation, Tesla radiant technologies, and you pre-build them in a factory and drop them off on site, then what you end up with is a house that's about 50 to 70% less expensive. There's less waste. Everything's pre-built for your home. You just have, like a car, you customize the color, you customize the glass, you customize your interiors, and you drop it on site in pieces. And now your house is built in a week instead of over 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on that same design concept that we're using out of World's Nest right now, we've got a phase two coming into World's Nest where we're coming up with a house that's built for under $120,000 that's over 2,200 square feet. So we pulled in our engineers from Rolls-Royce, which is Joe Holden, Dr. Nakamatsu, Shelby Henderson. We've got some other gentlemen that came in from Pepperdine. And we've engineered up a fantastic concept house that has radiant floors using shipping container designs where we peeled the steel off the side of these shipping containers that are 40 feet long, 9 feet high, 8 feet wide. You put six of them across, six of them high. They're $5,000 a piece. You put some insulation in them. You put some glass on them, a couple of solar panels on top. Boom, you've got a house for $80,000 that's shipping container strength strong and can survive any storm.
What about looks?
Oh, they're gorgeous. If you pull up a lot of shipping container designs that they're doing over in England and Germany and Norway and Sweden, they've been perfecting this look for a long time. If you wanted an entirely beautiful blue and green glass house, you can have it. If you want wood paneling, you can have it. If you want a Japanese-style house, you can have it. They're just an iron-framed box, so you can put whatever siding on it you want. When you tell people shipping container house, they think big red shipping box that comes in the back of a train.
Mm-hmm.
Let me tell you, there is no building department that's going to let you put that in a city. Nobody wants that living next to them, so they won't let you keep the red siding up. What you have to do is you've got to peel the siding off or you've got to panel over it anyway. So what you end up with is a really beautifully strong, safe house that's inexpensive, that's stormproof, that's been proven to stand the seas. You know, between crossing the United States and China, these things are going around the planet every 5 seconds. You've got 10 million of these things sitting all over the place. And if you wanted to provide emergency housing for people in another Katrina-like situation, look what you've got. You've got tankers sitting on standby all around the planet with thousands of these things sitting on them. There's almost, from what I understand, there's over 200,000 of these things just sitting on the docks in Long Beach that are abandoned because of our shipping regulations between China and the United States. They ship things here. We store them, but we don't ship back, so we end up with empty shipping containers sitting on the lot.
They don't ship back the empty ones?
They don't. They sit right here in Long Beach.
So that's how we're getting our steel back?
That's how we're getting our steel back. I hope somebody's working out a really good recycling plan. But literally, there was news stories last year in Los Angeles where these shipping containers are sitting now almost 6 to 7 stories high, blocking out the sunsets from the local neighborhoods. Now, these are an unused resource for housing sitting right here in the United States. We could ship these down to Mexico and provide housing if we wanted to. We could fit every single one of these containers up, which are between 400 and 800 square feet, put a garden roof on them, glass up the walls, put them on sticks, and provide a hydrogen on demand or a alcohol fuel generator. Put an alcohol fuel generator diesel at the bottom of these things. Give somebody an alcohol still so they can produce their own fuel for their homes. And now you'd have a house that was maybe $20,000, 400 to 800 square feet, garden roof on top, alcohol fuel generator at the bottom. Boom, there's your emergency housing. It's safe, it's clean, it's impenetrable, and it's now. You can have it. You don't have to wait for somebody to provide it to you.
For windows, where you just take a welder to the, open it up?
Literally. That's what you actually do. You take a welder to it, you slice yourself a hole, you slide some glass and a frame right into it.
Huh. Are you familiar with Skybuild, the company that uses the shipping containers as a for the a Dell equivalent of solar and wind energy? They have these modules that plug into these things, so it's kind of a drop-and-go emergency system that you can make to order. You say, oh, I want 3 solar panels, I want battery system, I want...
I have seen this. It's a brilliant module.
Yeah.
We actually have almost a duplicate of it out at World's Nest. There's a power module out there that's also a gray water treatment center. So what you'd have is, let's say, for example, you just moved in and you want a 20-foot container that has your gray water recycling system and your alcohol fuel power plant built right into it with the generators and your control systems. You wheel it in, you drop it off, you attach it to the house, and you go.
It's a really brilliant
idea. Actually, what you're describing right now, I think, is going to be the future of gray water and power generation for new homes. I really do. I think that's 5, maybe 8 years out. But I think what's going to happen when people want to start transitioning off the grid, you're not going to be able to hand somebody a how-to kit. They're going to want some kind of facilitated box that's got a warranty on it you could attach to the back of their house, that they go back there and they had 2 switches on and off, and maybe put fuel in every now and then.
Now, one of the concepts at World's Nest is also self-sustaining food. So you're growing your own food, isn't it?
It's a big aspect of World's Nest. What we have inside is you've got a tropical rainforest that's the front edge of the house. The house is built into 3 sections, and it's barriered off for radiant heat purposes. So towards the edge of the house where the windows are, you've got a huge gray water pond. It goes through an anaerobic digester, so you have a lot of bacteria eating up all the material in the gray water. But there's a natural filtering system, which is banana trees and tropical plants and fruit plants. What you're doing is you're growing your own food year-round using your gray wastewater to feed your own planting system. That also keeps the humidity up inside, which is great for desert climates. So you always have a nice 40 to 60% humidity buildup, which is also really good for your health. That way you don't have dry nostrils and you're getting a lot less bacteria. So it's a really brilliant system of regenerating and recycling. It's a closed-loop system. The whole house is actually a giant closed-loop system. The same kind of programs that they're trying to develop for the moon and Mars, actually. You take a house like this, you build it into 3 parts. You have radiant walls so that each section can be barriered off from the next one, so that as you're in the center of the house towards your bedrooms, it's really cozy warm at 70 degrees. The next layer may be 60, and if it's really cold outside, the last layer is probably 45 degrees or so. But the water and the plants and the walls hold so much radiant heat that it rarely gets under 65, 70. And it's a gray water, black water food recycling station.
And that's with what temperatures outside?
Oh, when I was there, we were pushing 20 degrees when I was there last, and we had a meeting there. And I don't think it got below 65 degrees in the house with no heating, no air conditioning running.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just from the radiant heat from the walls and the fact that they had this really brilliant 3-layer capture system.
When you say a closed-loop system, you're referring to water, food, sewage,
that's correct.
Waste.
That's correct. And let's talk about the waste aspect for just a second. There's a new system that we're implementing out there right now. We have a gasification system, which has been tested out there. And the gasification system that they had out there recently was a tire digester. It's being run right in Texas right now for final prototyping and testing. But they had a tire digester that was being used eventually to run all sorts of garbage. And this garbage would condense things down into a methane fuel. So you'd put a car tire in. For every car tire, you'd get 3 gallons of methane fuel out of it, which you could use to run the generators in the house. So with the other unrecyclables, other unfood recyclables, what you have attached to the house is a small gasifier. You put your unrecyclables in there. It exhausts off no garbage. You've got no carbon going into the atmosphere. You get carbon monoxide, which is a byproduct of all these things. But you end up with a methane fuel, a really clean methane fuel that you can use to continue running your generators with. So we've taken an unrecyclable plastic product, gasified it, which is nothing more than a big pressure oven at very high temperature, reduced it down to its constituent components. You get a block of carbon on one side and a bunch of fuel on the other side to run your generators with. So we try to keep it as closed loop as possible.
So that's a plasma system?
That system there is not a plasma system, but we've branched off. Here's what's happened with World's Nest in the last year. It's gotten very advanced out there because we've become a think tank for a lot of engineers around the world. World's Nest Phase 1, which is what you see on the World's Nest website at worldsnest.com, was the first prototype. That's the 10,000-square-foot mansion that's off the grid. World's Nest Phase 2 is going in place right now, which I guess I'm announcing it for the first time. Sterling, I'm announcing World's Nest Phase 2 coming into action here.
Right.
World's Nest Phase 2 is going to be probably one of the most advanced closed-loop house systems in the world. It's going to be an ongoing research think tank facility and an education center for sustainable engineering. What we're doing is we're taking Joe Holden, Shelby Henderson, Dr. Yoshiro Nakamatsu, and a lot of other engineers that have come forward, and we're literally turning them into a curriculum. We're downloading them onto high definition. We're putting together apprenticeship programs where now you can get a 10-year Rolls-Royce education in 4 months on sustainable engineering. You're going to learn about wind power. You're going to really learn about water power. You're going to learn aerodynamics. You're going to learn thermodynamics. You're going to learn everything you need to know about gasification, plasma waste digestion, all of it in a sweep. No one's ever tried to compile a course like this. I was over at the Scripps Institute of Oceanography recently. We formed an official alliance with them because we feel that we've got the technologies that will help reverse the decline of the planet but also save the oceans. We're putting together with Joe Holden, we're planning, I got to say planning, I can never say it's there until it's there, but we're planning through World's Nest Phase 2 to implement the first fleet of green ships that will be running on an alcohol fuel engine, using his thrust tube turbine design. Now, Joe Holden's thrust tube design, I gotta take a step back here, is extraordinary. This is the guy who almost engineered your present day turbines that are used in all of our jets. All of our flight that we have right now is based on the thrust tube concept from the 1940s. He engineered this up when he was working with Rolls-Royce. He was a Rolls-Royce engineer for 45 years. He engineered the Concorde jet. This gentleman is, there's some things I can tell you and some things I can't. Classified military boat engineer. Okay, so he took the thrust tube rocket that he engineered in the 1940s for Rolls-Royce that ended up going into all of our F-15s, F-16s, and Hornets and all those other nice fighter planes that we've got. And he engineered this thrust tube design, which is a very exotic turbine design, into a boat design. So it uses half the fuel of a standard boat and goes 4 to 5 times as fast as the fastest boat in the world. Really, really, really elegant, beautiful design concept. Now, on that same thrust tube concept that he has, and you can find some references to Joe Holden on YouTube and see this thing, he's also built micro hydro turbines that are 20 to 30% more efficient than the most efficient water turbine in the world. It's a two-stage turbine design. Very elegant, very beautiful. We're taking that thrust tube turbine concept now, and we're putting it into green boats, green micro hydro turbine systems, and larger hydro turbine systems.
We've got a feature page on that at PezWiki.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Mm-hmm. He also has one of the world's most efficient windmill systems that he built down at St. Croix. He built it about 20 years ago, and it survived over 5 hurricanes. It's got 3 blades on it on 1 giant rotating arm, and it'll follow the wind wherever it goes. The genius of his system, there's a proprietary aspect that I can't describe, but there's ingeniousness to his system. There's a reason it survived 5 hurricanes. There's a proprietary design concept that he's going to be licensing out very soon. He built this for less than $20,000. It's a 5 to 7 kilowatt generator. The center windmill acts as a pump for water. The two on each edge act as your power generation, your electrical power generation, and it spins according to the wind. It's a beautiful, smart design, and I think that you may even be able to find that on YouTube as well.
Uh-huh. Well, we're going to have to put pause, press the pause button on this particular segment. We've come to the end of our hour here. This has been a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you coming on, and we'll have to do it again in about another 6 months.
You're very welcome, Sterling.
And get another idea that we can put on our site, and one less thing you have to put in your movie.
Sounds good, man. Thank you.
Is there a website that, besides World's Nest, we do have a feature page about you at PezWiki.
Would recommend keep on PezWiki, but keep your eye on World's Nest. There's going to be a change this week. I'm going to give you something, as a matter of fact. Keep your eye on World's Nest this week because we're doing a massive overhaul of the website to show you what's coming up on World's Nest Phase 2. It's going to talk a little bit about the film, but for you specifically, Sterling, I'm going to give you an exclusive 2-minute Dr. Ishiro Nakamatsu interview that I shot in high definition last year.
Cool.
And it'll be linked up between World's Nest and your site, specifically for your listeners.
That'd be awesome. Well, Chris, thanks again, and keep up the great work.
Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.